On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was a week of earthquake and plane crashes, diplomatic tiffs, and a bleary-eyed tussle over troops in Iraq. Ambassador Ryan Crocker told lawmakers yesterday that one word sums up Iraq.
If there is one word that I would use to sum up the atmosphere in Iraq, on the street, in the countryside, in the neighborhoods, and at the national level, that word would be fear.
On Capitol Hill, Democrats pulled out cots but failed to pull out the troops. Senator Carl Levin said the public sees the effort.
What they did see today is who is fighting day and night to change the course in Iraq.
And President Bush said the U.S. will hold a Middle East summit to boost Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, not Hamas.
So in Gaza and the West Bank and beyond, the international community must stand with the brave men and women who are working for peace.
Joining us today to dig into the headlines from Philadelphia, Trudy Rubin, globe-trotting foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
With us from Washington, D.C. is Margaret Tolliv, national congressional correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers. Margaret, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
Good to have you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Trudy, and Margaret.
Let's see. Margaret, let's go to your turf first off. We had cots in the foyer of the Senate there. At the end of it all, nothing really changed. And the next day, the generals say, oh, not September, but November. What's going on, Margaret?
Yeah, that didn't go over great in the briefing room. Well, what's going on, I think, is that we're in a real holding pattern waiting for the water to boil. Democrats have made clear what they want to do. Republicans are really divided on what they want to do. Everybody promised September is going to be the turning point, and I think the calls to wait until November are really only going to strain further the Republicans who have said, give us till September to decide.
Margaret, there were a dozen or so Republicans in advance of this all-nighter who said they were breaking ranks with the president in some degree. How did the vote actually shake out? Did any of them actually peel away from President Bush and current war policy?
There's really been no change. There were three Republicans who were co-sponsoring that amendment to begin combat troop withdrawals from Iraq. And at the end of the day, it was really only those three who were still in favor of it. A fourth, Susan Collins, had also voted with them to say, no filibuster, let's bring this thing to a vote. But she said if it came down to a vote, she wouldn't vote for it. So they're not ready to do that yet. They're not there.
And without 60 votes in the Senate, is there anything the Democrats can do, or is it just steady or unsteady as she goes, Margaret?
Well, it depends on what they can do. If you're asking, is there anything they can do to force troop withdrawals, the answer is no. If you're asking, is there anything they can do to campaign, put election pressure on Republicans, or try to sort of shave a little bit of support around the sides for something weaker, yes, certainly there's things they can do.
And there's a lot of that going on. Let's listen to a couple of the generals. It was the ambassador plus two generals who were speaking out yesterday. First, here's General David Petraeus, top U.S. commander in Iraq, telling lawmakers at a closed-door Pentagon briefing, well, he told them earlier that the surge in U.S. troops had achieved some success. Later, in an NPR interview, after his testimony, he explained what he said in that briefing.
The surge of forces has now turned into a surge of offensive operations, and that began about a month ago, and that has achieved tactical momentum, success in a number of areas against the al-Qaeda in Iraq elements, some success as well against the Iranian-supported Shia extremist militia elements, and a new development in recent months, which is the support of Iraqi people and sheikhs in a number of areas and opposition to al-Qaeda on their part, which is something that has helped our effort considerably, especially in Anbar province to the west of Baghdad, which you'll recall was a very, very tough neighborhood for a number of years.
some of the positive face put forward yesterday by General David Petraeus. General Ray Odierno, the number two, was also talking back to the states yesterday. He said, and I quote here, "In order to do a good assessment, I need at least until November." That's after September. He finished his briefing with a dramatic story about a young Marine on his second deployment who said things were better and he needed more time.
He went on to say that the deployment this time was entirely different. Witnessing rebuilding projects, more Iraqi security forces, more normal daily routines, and a dramatic improvement in the security situation. He then looked at my sergeant major and asked, "We're not going to be given enough time to finish this, are we, Command Sergeant Major?" I'll just end it with that. I hope that that young Marine warrior is wrong.
There, General Ray Odierno yesterday. Trudy Rubin, all of a sudden, after the Senate's overnight, we've got the ambassador, we've got Petraeus, we've got Odierno. They're all talking like crazy back to Washington. What's the meaning of the big push and the push out of the date for a conclusive report to November?
The September report was never supposed to be conclusive. I was in Iraq in June. I saw both Petraeus and Crocker, and they described the September report as only a snapshot. What's happened is that the Washington clock is moving much faster than Baghdad. There is a deadline, however, and everyone in the military knows about it and talks about it, and the deadline is March, April, because that is when the military basically runs out of fresh troops to keep up the rotations that would maintain the levels at the levels they are now. And so everyone in the military expects there will be a drawdown in starting in March, and there's all kinds of informal discussions going on among senior commanders, although it hasn't been finalized, about how many troops will be left at the end of 2008, and there's speculation it could be down to 50 to 80,000. So the natural deadline is already there. I think what the military is struggling for is more time. And they're hoping to get until December to do as much as they can do with the extra troops, and to hope against hope that on the political side some way is found to get something moving so that there is some Iraqi government to turn over to. And I think that's the key, and I think that's where Congress should be focusing on. I think they have more leverage than they realize, and they're not using it to get the administration to move on the political and diplomatic side, where on the diplomatic side, really very little is being done, and that is crucial.
Trudy, you wrote this week, "It was painful to watch President Bush toss away what may be his last chance to head off a total Iraq disaster." What do you mean?
I feel that at this point, if you're going to start planning for the kind of regional and international diplomacy that the Iraqi study group called for, and I think that is their most important recommendation, you have to start planning now. I think the president had a chance because there probably is a workable 60-vote, maybe even 70-vote group in the bipartisan group in Congress that would go for endorsing the Iraqi study group. But that's meaningless if the president then doesn't do something with it. He could have used that as a cover to start the kind of behind-the-scenes activity. You need preparation for this. For an international conference that involves the regional players, where the U.S. puts all its muscle with some kind of an umbrella over formation, whether it's United Nations, Security Council, Perm 5, to get the neighbors involved. Because right now, the neighbors, Saudi Arabia and Iran, they're fueling their proxy, Sunnis and Shia, inside Iraq, because they are afraid of each other. The Iranians are afraid that the Sunnis are going to take back over power in Iraq. The Saudis are afraid that Iran is going to control Iraq. Unless there's a new regional agreement brokered by someone, with the U.S. strongly taking part, when U.S. troops leave, there is going to be a much, much worse civil war. I don't think there's any question about it, and it is going to cause havoc that will involve us for many years to come.
Jack Beatty, let me ask you. Trudy says September was always just a snapshot, but my goodness, it's been talked about a lot and very prominently as the thing we must wait for. Now November, we hear.
Yes, and the other thing we heard again and again and again was the name David Petraeus. The Republicans, every Republican speaker, it seemed, senator, was saying we have to put our trust in General Petraeus. President Bush, in a recent speech, quoted him 11 different times. And, you know, it's useful to take a look at him. I'm sure he's an honest broker in his way. But Glenn Greenwald, the blogger at Salon, has a cull of statements of his going back, to 2003, of over-optimistic, if not downright political statements about progress in Iraq, and including his coming out very early and saying something about they had found mobile germ warfare facilities there, you know, those trucks that were never discovered. So he's not the best witness, at least judging by his past behavior, for a wholly credible report. And he didn't help himself in that regard this week by going on Hugh Hewitt's radio program. I don't know much about Hewitt, but he's described as a right-wing commentator, talk show host. So that didn't help, and he's being cited, of course, as if he's going to be some sort of objective broker about progress in Iraq.
We're looking at a week in the news this hour with our weekly Friday News Roundtable. Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader, in a briefing on Wednesday, said Republicans had changed the normal rules for the all-night Iraq debate, said they're to blame for the 60 votes that were needed to move forward on withdrawing the troops.
All of a sudden now, 7 months later, after the last defense authorization bill, they're saying you need 60 votes. That's a new math that was developed by the Republicans to protect the president. That's what it's all about.
Senate Minority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell of Kentucky saying the same day he's glad Republicans scuttled a Democratic proposal ordering troop withdrawals to begin from Iraq.
I was pleased at the outcome. It's a clear indication that a proposal to try to micromanage the surge before it's hardly begun is not going to pass in the Senate.
Jack, Margaret, Trudy, I should share with you, there's a new, I'm not sure what to call this, clarification coming out of the Pentagon right now from General Odierno saying, quoting him, there's no intention to push our reporting requirement beyond September. Nothing I said yesterday should be interpreted to suggest otherwise, my reference to November simply suggesting that as we go forward beyond September, we will gain more understanding of trends. Margaret Talava, they do have a requirement to come in September, and yet it does seem like the boundaries are being pushed further out there in the general's comments this week.
That's right. I think there's an effort to do both. I mean, they promised to come back in September, and it sounds to everyone at this point as though that report in September is going to sound an awful lot like the report that we just got, the interim report. And I think what the administration is trying to do is say, well, we're not going to have proof by September that this is working. So Minority Leader John Boehner, Senator John Warner, all these folks who've said, well, all bets may be off in September, please take the next several weeks to consider changing your mind.
You know, Margaret, Trudy was suggesting there that despite all of this, we are likely to see troop drawdowns, significant ones, next year. I've seen just the opposite interpretation of this sort of pushing the deadline out. What are you hearing, feeling on Capitol Hill? Do people expect that behind all of this, the Bush administration itself has drawdowns in mind, or the opposite?
No, I think Trudy's right. I think people do think that that's true, but March and April are a long way away. And, you know, don't forget, I mean, there is a 2008 election coming up, and it's impossible, and it would be naive, to entirely take the politics out of this debate. You know, Democrats want troop withdrawals, but they want credit for troop withdrawals. And, Republicans, many of them sort of want troop withdrawals. Many of them are honestly torn about whether that's the right thing to do, whether the Civil War sort of onslaught that would follow in the immediate future, would be worthwhile, and whether it would be short-lived. And people are very afraid of the consequences in human terms and in political terms, and it's all coming together at the same time.
Let's take a call from Steve in Providence, Rhode Island. Steve, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I wanted to make two somewhat linked comments and have your commentators react. Mm-hmm. One is, I want somebody to take up my thought that does Major General Odierno have no shame by using this young Marine as a reason why somehow we should continue on in Iraq? And linked to that is this question of how far down the road is the can going to be kicked? I remember when you had Senator McCain on, I think it was in March or so of 2006, and I was on your show, and I asked McCain on that show, how long are we there? Well, a couple of more months. Yeah. That was a year and a half ago. So those two questions, and I think particularly the shamelessness of Ordiano to abuse that Marine that way is appalling.
Steve, we hear that question, and it stands large there. Let me get one more call, then I'll go to our panel. Roxana is calling from Boston. Roxana, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You don't want to hear my comment because I'm too confused and too upset to talk about this war. But I'm here to tell you about my son, who is a Marine in the Anbar region.
Okay.
He's there for the third time deployed. He was there the first time for the fall of Baghdad, second time in Fallujah, and now he's in the Anbar region.
What do you hear from him, Roxana?
And I hear that things are so much better. And I know, and you can imagine, I'm in no way going to use my son or his Marines. I have too much respect for all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised and I was amazed to hear this. He's emailing me and telling that things are better. The Iraqis have more control over their villages. They go around more peacefully around their daily life. And he said if the press will concentrate more on these good things than on the bombs in Iraq and in Baghdad, they may have more chances.
Roxana,
I'm just giving you his comments, and he's a good man, and he's an extraordinary Marine commander.
We believe that, and we send him our prayers and best wishes. We thank you for that. Trudy Rubin, you hear that directly from Roxana's son. At the same time, I heard David Petraeus saying yesterday that ultimately this is going to be decided in exactly those mean streets in Baghdad and the sectarian tensions there.
There is no question that things are better in Anbar. I wrote about this when I was there. I have consistently talked to tribal leaders in Anbar over the years. We made terrible mistakes there in the beginning. Anbar could have been stable in the beginning if we had dealt fairly with these tribal leaders. I won't go into this. It's history. We're now doing what we should have done 4 years ago. The thing is that Anbar is a wholly Sunni region, so right there the problem is not so much civil war.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened is that Sunni sheikhs have turned against al-Qaeda in Iraq, which initially they supported because they were against our being there. Mm-hmm. But al-Qaeda in Iraq has turned so heinous, it's chopping off local heads. They turned against them. They're fighting against them. And in a sense, they've become allied with the U.S. because they're afraid of what's going to happen when U.S. troops leave, because Sunnis are the minority, and they're afraid now that the Shiite-led government is stronger, they will get slaughtered. So what it all comes back to is whether you can find some kind of political reconciliation, because in truth, the troops are doing better in certain areas, largely because tribal groups, heavily Sunni but some Shia, are working with them and controlling their own areas. We haven't been able to get that kind of consistent help from the Iraqi security forces that we've trained, but we're getting it from local people on the ground who are concerned about their future. The question is, how do you build on that politically? The Iraqi government is divided by sect and religion. It seems unable to come to reconciliation itself. What the military is betting on is that if you could eliminate some of the most heinous car bombs, and so far that succeeded in some areas, but the car bombers, who are al-Qaeda and hardline Sunni Islamists, are moving elsewhere. The bet is if you could cut down on that, you could create an atmosphere in which the politicos might come together. What I would argue is they can't do it alone. There has to be regional pressure, diplomatic pressure, and now is the moment. I think it is worth waiting because there is some progress. But if you don't build on it, then we are going to leave in 2008 and it will fall apart again. Now is the moment for the kind of diplomacy that this administration so far has seemed unable to muster. So if, I would say, 12 good men or 17 good men Republicans have to go to the White House in a Hugh Scott moment, like when Senator Scott went to see Nixon and say, if you want our support, you have got to bring back James Baker or whatever. The diplomatic process must go forward now to build on this military progress before we do withdraw in 2008, irrespective of the political debate back home.
I wish I were as well, I don't know. I have to say I'm not so sure about that big 2008 withdrawal, but I understand the point. Jack, I want to get you, but let me
not
go first.
Not completely. But
well, even to 50 or 80,000. We will see. Let's go to Narragansett, Rhode Island. Pete, you're on the air.
Hello.
What do you think, Pete?
I think that the story that I'm not hearing is the stories that are telling George Bush that the emperor has no clothes. An example is that this Marine that talked to his commander.
Yep.
You know, one, it's an anecdotal story, and two, nobody seems to have remembered that the president actually had a press conference that was rehearsed on an open mic and then, kind of made a fool of, but, you know, a few years ago with a whole contingent.
So what do you need to hear now, Pete? What do you need to hear? What are you looking for?
I want to see Congress start being offensive in their proposals. Right now they're reacting to the president. They're saying, well, we may cut off funding, but I don't see any forward-thinking alternate solutions being put forward.
And you'd like to hear them? Let me get one more. Joe in Boston. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that I'm a former Army officer that spent two tours in Iraq. And although you're not discussing it specifically, I believe that we cannot sustain the numbers we currently have there. It is destroying the Army and Marine Corps. I saw recruitment and retention just becoming abysmal. And when I left in 2006, my peers left with me. And I was in the 2nd Brigade, 3rd Infantry Division. Of maybe 30 or 40 peers that were captains, maybe two stayed in.
When you say you left, not just Iraq, you left the service.
I left the service, correct. We cannot sustain the rate that we're currently going. It's a year deployed, now 15 months deployed, a year or less at home. And during that year, you're also spending months training. And I just believe that we cannot sustain this level, regardless of whether or not we think we're turning it around in Iraq, which I believe we're not.
Joe, that's a good reality check. Jack Beatty?
Could I just say one quick thing? That is why every military commander I spoke with expects that there will start to be a drawdown next year. That is specifically the reason why, because the military can't take it.
Jack, how about it? There's a reality check on military strength and also a political fact of life. It's 08 coming up. Does it say to you that, you know, after all the sound and fury, we will be pulling out substantially sometime next year or not?
I just don't know. I mean, I read that, in fact, to pull everybody out in an orderly way would take 2 years.
Well, everybody's another issue,
right? Yeah, but that it would take a year or more even to get it down by half. Now, there are proposals for redeployment of forces. There are proposals for, vastly increasing the number of trainers. Maybe that will be the way they will want to go. But the fact is, one person is the story here, George W. Bush. And if he isn't going to change, it's inconceivable to me that the Senate would get to 66 votes to override any sort of veto he has. So, and he earlier this week disturbed some senators when they were having a conference, and he came in and he said, basically, we're not going to be making any changes, or words to that effect. I'm staying the course. He doesn't want to face what is at the end of this road, and what is at the end of it was dramatized, I think, in the National Intelligence Estimate, which not only showed that after 5+ years, we're right back where we started from in regard to Al-Qaeda. Instead of having bases in Afghanistan, they're across the border in Pakistan, but that through our activities through the war in Iraq, we have started a whole new chain of terrorism. Indeed, you know, Bush has been saying that we're fighting the terrorists in Iraq so we don't have to fight them here. But the NIA reveals the opposite is more like the case, that because we're fighting them in Iraq, we're more likely to face them there here. And Bush, for Bush to face the dimensions of this failure, which he'd have to do in withdrawing troops, that seems to me I can't conceive that happening before January of 2009.
Let's go to Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you, Tom?
Very well. What do you see?
Well, I think the news of the week, from my perspective, is contempt, and it's the contempt that this administration has towards Congress, and it has shown up in several different stories. Today we learned in the Washington Post that the administration is prohibiting the U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C. from enforcing any of the congressional subpoenas. And as
or contempt citations, either one. They will not act even if Congress wants to.
And what that means is that that essentially negates any possibility of congressional oversight, because the executive gets to determine whether its acts are proper or not.
Right.
The second story relating to that is the Odierno November statement. This administration let Republican congressmen talk for 24 hours about the need to wait for September, and as soon as the vote passed, Odierno comes out and says, well, actually, it's November. And I think that's also contemptuous of any congressional oversight. And the third, and perhaps most troubling, is that a member, a senator on the House, on the Senate Armed Services Committee, Hillary Clinton, in May, wrote to the Defense Department and asked if they were making any contingency plans for withdrawing troops. And she got a response on Thursday from an undersecretary that not only was contemptuous, but actually said that her raising the questions reinforces enemy propaganda that the United States will abandon its allies in Iraq. And this is a completely contemptuous administration, and they seem to be operating under the principle that whatever doesn't get them impeached only makes them stronger. And I'm afraid that we're heading for that type of confrontation.
Mark, thanks for that rundown. Margaret Tolliver, what about the Hillary Clinton inquiry and the Pentagon's response? It was kind of remarkable. I mean, everybody is saying we've got to think about getting out sometime. She asks, and she's told, you know, that's almost giving aid and comfort to the enemy.
That's right. They essentially suggested that she was sort of an enemy propagandist. And she posted it on her website, so things are absolutely building to a colossal battle over executive powers, but they always have been with the administration. And Vice President Dick Cheney has always strongly felt that the executive has strong powers that President Bush has, and you see all of this playing out in the conflict over the U.S. attorneys and over the war. And I do think that part of the sort of over-the-cliff question about how the Senate votes on the Iraq war is, does it matter? Even if they could get the 60 votes, A, could they override it? Probably not, if the president had a veto. Or B, would the president sign a signing statement or disregard them? And how would it be challenged? Would it go to court? If it went to court, could it be expedited in time for it to matter before the end of President Bush's term?
We're looking at a week in the news, the Iraq all-nighter in the Senate going nowhere. A real Iraq report gets pushed to November. A big report on al-Qaeda and more executive privilege very much in the news. And lots going on elsewhere this week. A steam pipe burst in a Manhattan subway, creating an eerily familiar cloud of chaos.
People were running around with soot all over them. Someone said it was a war bomb. Someone said the building was on fire. Someone said the building collapsed. There were so many rumors going on at that point.
A big earthquake in Japan caused a leak in the world's largest nuclear power plant, sent emergency workers scrambling. And when Emmy nominations came out, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee led the pack.
Let it be known that I, Sitting Bull, was the last chief to give up his rifle.
Let it be known and remembered. We're looking at a week in the news. Trudy Rubens here, Margaret Tolliver, and Jack Beattie. Right now, Bill's calling from Boise, Idaho. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I found it interesting that Homeland Security Advisor Frances Townsend, she held a press conference on al-Qaeda and the latest NIE and made the rounds of some morning news shows this week, because she's the person required by National Security Directive, Presidential Directive 51, to submit in a couple of weeks, I think August 9th actually, an implementation plan for NSPD 51, which authorizes the president, in consultation with the vice president, to lead all three branches of government in providing continuity. It's a continuity of government plan, or COG, in the event of an emergency, which is defined very broadly by NSPD 51, and I'm quoting here, any incident, regardless of location, that results in damage or disruption affecting the U.S. population, infrastructure, environment, economy, or government functions. There's a provision in NSPD 51 that could be invoked in anticipation of an event because due to the asymmetrical nature of the current situation, as they like to call it. And there are several annexes to the directive that are classified, so only the executive branch knows what they contain.
Bill, does it sound like good crisis planning to you or something else?
Well, my question is for the panel, is anyone paying attention to this? And do they think that Cheney Bush will walk away in 2009?
That's
a big one. Bill, thank you. Jack?
Yeah, this came out a couple of months ago, and the Washington Post, as I remember, had it on page 17 or something like that, and people did on the blogs. There was a lot of concern about it, but as people looked into it, they found that this was basically the usual crisis planning, that there was nothing... unusually sinister about it.
Every president's had that same power, or
perhaps not. But that this wasn't as sinister as our caller just construed it.
Margaret, what about it on Capitol Hill? Is Congress looking that skeptically at this president?
Well, that's an open-ended question. The attention has been so entirely directed on the Iraq war in terms of most of the attention the last couple of weeks that the rounds that Fran Townsend is making have not been generating an enormous amount of buzz or talk on the Hill. But, you know, it's entirely possible there are some people trying to deconstruct all this. It just hasn't been the focus of most of the attention on the Hill.
Trudy.
Just one remark, and it really relates to something we talked about in the last segment. Mm-hmm. When you talk about Congress looking skeptically at the White House, this business about the Pentagon official who accused Hillary Clinton of practically being traitorous for asking about contingency plans, what struck me is that Senators Lugar and Warner, Republican stalwarts, put forward an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill which called just for that, to have contingency plans for withdrawal. So, in effect, the Pentagon is accusing Republican bulwarks of being traitorous. And I just wonder how long it's going to be before Republican anger in the Senate boils over and you will have a visitation to the White House that is serious and forces the president to listen. Maybe that's impossible, but I find it an intriguing thought.
Trudy, I want to listen in on another former general and former Secretary of State for a minute. An interesting kind of virtual back and forth here between former Secretary of State Colin Powell and current Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice on the Middle East and Palestinians and Israelis here. Here is Colin Powell telling NPR this week that he would talk with the Palestinian militant group Hamas and take a different approach than his successor, current Secretary of State Rice.
I think you'd have to find some way to talk to Hamas. I don't want to insert myself into what Secretary Rice is doing or what the president is doing, but they are not going to go away.
They're not going to go away. Find some way to talk with them. Condoleezza Rice told NPR that Hamas cannot continue violence and expect to be invited to the negotiating table in future talks.
It's very hard to imagine a partner for peace that refuses to renounce violence and refuses to recognize the right of the other partner to even exist. And so I find rather strange the notion that we should somehow try and engage Hamas rather than to work with and strengthen the Palestinian president.
Trudy, put this in context for us. Very unusual to have Colin Powell speaking up this directly in opposition to current policy. The president himself announcing an initiative this week to restart the peace process in the Middle East. Rice saying no way Hamas will be part of it. Powell saying right in her face practically, well, it should be.
What I find amazing is that even if you follow what Secretary Rice said, that she wants to strengthen the Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas and his Fatah movement, which is opposed to Hamas. What they are doing right now, policy-wise, is so bizarre, so inept, and so destined to fail.
What are they doing?
They have called for a conference, but they don't even call it a conference. They call it a meeting. And initially, it's supposed to be in the fall. They haven't set a date. And initially, the buzz was, and Tony Snow even came out and talked about it, it was sort of billed as an international peace conference. They've invited the Arab neighbors, everyone that is willing to deal with Israel, to come to this conference. And the idea, the thought was they were going to try to restart a peace process. Mm. If you read the fine print in the president's speech, what it's supposed to be about is a conference on building Palestinian institutions, the idea that you can somehow build a democracy on the West Bank, which is now separated from Gaza. This is as delusionary as the idea that you could build a democracy in Iraq during a war. The West Bank is under total security shutdown, and one town is
by
separated.
By Fatah or by the Israelis or both?
By Israeli security mm-hmm. measures. Israeli troops are in the West mm-hmm. Bank because mm-hmm. The Israelis feel it's insecure, and the Americans have asked for lifting of roadblocks. The Israelis say they can't do it because of security considerations. There's no economy. Fatah is weak. Abbas is weak. The only way the United States can strengthen Abbas is to put forward a real proposal for reinstituting some kind of peace process, which they're not doing. So again, it's all illusionary. Before you even get to the question of whether you talk to Hamas, if they were going to have a peace conference, it needs months of preparations, which don't seem to be in process. They're ignoring a peace plan that was put forward by the Saudis and the Arab League that really has some oomph and would recognize Israel. So you just don't feel that this administration is serious about diplomacy, and the Middle East is case number one, and I think Iraq is the even more pressing case.
Let's go to Kevin in Iowa City. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
The question that I had, or the thing that mm-hmm. I found most interesting, was last night they ran some tapes from the FEMA trailer about how there was formaldehyde leaks.
This is back in Katrina days, the formaldehyde
back in Katrina days, but all the people lived in the trailers. There's formaldehyde gas that leaks out.
Yep.
And it's poisoning, but they knew of that, but they didn't want to test it because there'd be government culpability. And it just goes to show you how little this administration cares about the actual people that live here. And it's just so propaganda driven that, it's just one thing after the other where the people in the country, it's about image.
Of course, people needed shelter, and maybe that's what they had. Margaret Tolliff, I haven't been able to keep up with that one, the formaldehyde in the trailers. What wrong there, do you know?
Well, I know that this is basically a new disclosure, and I know very little about it beyond that, except for that I do think that Hurricane Katrina is yet another issue on the domestic side that Democrats are banking on Republicans sort of giving to them for free, so that once either the war debate, I don't think the war debate will subside, but once it's put in context and an election year is really underway, you'll see issues like SCHIP, like children's health insurance, anything to do with Hurricane Katrina sort of rise up as these sort of freebie domestic issues for Democrats to try to claim and run with. And I think it's a real problem. It's a problem for Republicans as well as the administration.
Give us the latest on the health insurance for children. President Bush threatening to veto an expansion of that program this week. What's the expansion that's being described there, and why is the president coming out against health care for kids?
I'll try to break this down in simple terms. It's sort of complicated, though. It's a government health insurance coverage program for children, and it needed more money to keep up with sort of basic needs. The administration proposed like $5 billion, and Congress said, no, and we need way more than that, and is moving to double it. And it was passed out of a committee last night. It'll be on the floor probably for a final Senate vote before they go out for their recess. And what it would do is raise cigarette taxes about, I think, 61 cents a pack. So it'd be a dollar in federal cigarette taxes to help pay for it. And what the administration is saying is that it would veto it in part because this is something that the private sector should be picking up, and because this is too much like government-run health care.
But does the whole program go away? This has been a widely praised program, picking up kids without health insurance and helping them out. Does it go away if the president vetoes or not?
Well, that's at risk. I have a hard time believing that it's going to happen, but this is definitely a game of political chicken right now between Capitol Hill and the White House and, you know, millions of people who depend on this coverage and the balance, primarily children.
Let's go to David in Barnstead, New Hampshire. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi. I think that caught my attention in terms of a surge has been the surge of the stock market past 14,000.
All-time number there, yeah.
Yeah, and what I don't know, what is this saying as far as I have no profound observation in terms of maybe the disconnect that I seem to sense between the surge in, you know, Iraq and the surge going on Wall Street? Or is there a disconnect? I mean, there's nothing sinister in that remark at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying, we seem to be living in two different spheres of activity. On the one hand, sort of a, you know, a financial, you know,
high watermark right there, yeah.
You know, and then on the other hand, the sacrifice of life on the other. I mean, I just find this very disconcerting, just as an observer of two sorts of surges, one financial, one
right
in the military sector.
David, let us pick it up. Trudy Rubin, what about it? 14,000, of course. I mean, it's a number. It's never been crossed before in percentage terms. You know, I'm hearing it's not so remarkable, people are saying. On the other hand, David points to the war. It comes at the same time as the debt being piled up to pay for that. It also comes at the same time that the dollar's been just in free fall this week against the euro and the pound. Connections there? How's one going up when the dollar's going down, Trudy?
Well, I think there. First of all, as someone pointed out, I mean, the stock market generally marches forward. It had limped for a long time, but secondly,
it falls down too sometimes. But yeah.
It falls down, but I mean, historically, it sort of eventually marches along. You remember, people were predicting in the last big boom that it was going to go up to what was it,
35,000?
Somebody wrote a book, so
yeah.
We're only at 14. But secondly, I think there's an enormous amount of capital out there. Oil prices are very high. You have countries looking for a place to invest. You have countries picking up our debt. Our debt is being picked up by China, by Middle Eastern countries. People are investing here, which enables a lot of debt to pile up here without paying the price. You wonder what would happen if China ever decided to pull it out, but they won't because they would lose too. And so you have sectors of the world economy where there's a lot of extra money being made, especially in oil prices, and people are putting it here.
Trudy, there's another story this week I want to ask you about. News just out today that the Supreme Court in Pakistan has voted to reinstate the Chief Justice that the President Pervez Musharraf there has been feuding with and kicked out, Iftikhar Chowdhury. He'll go back in. You've said recently in a lot of killings after the assault on the Red Mosque last week, a lot of bombings, attacks on Pakistani troops, you've said Pakistan may now be a bigger problem for the United States than Iraq. Really?
Pakistan has the bomb. Pakistan has a virulent Islamic movement. Pakistan has a section of its frontier province that is believed to be the place where Osama bin Laden is holding up in the mountains between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and it has a resurgent Taliban, which is nesting in those same territories on the border with Afghanistan, is now causing problems and bringing suicide bombs to Afghanistan. And Pakistan has a president who is under siege both from liberals and from Islamists. So, and Pakistan was actually the focus in this national intelligence estimate on terrorism, saying that Al-Qaeda had found a base in Pakistan. That's where the real base is.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So, yes, this needs to be a focus. The United States has backed Musharraf. Musharraf has to make a choice now. He's played footsie with the Islamists for a long time and let radical Muslim schools, madrasas, flourish, even though the U.S. has pressed him to try to reform them or build up the secular education system. This has to be a focus.
Margaret Teller, bring it home for us for just a minute. Rupert Murdoch seems poised to get the Dow Jones Company, the Wall Street Journal, unless something really spectacular happens here. How's the press corps in Washington responding to that?
Well, we're all watching. The Wall Street Journal, obviously a great newspaper, and we all work for newspaper companies, and our industry is going through, you know, major turbulent times right now. So there was a sort of development earlier this week where one of the directors quit in protest over this, but it doesn't seem to have stopped the Bancroft family from going ahead with their plans for further meetings next week. And, you know, I think we could hear a decision pretty soon.
Yeah. So, Jack, maybe change of ownership. Maybe the news will change with it.
Well, you know, that has happened with this man. And the New York Times ran a piece recently about how he operates. You know, if you're a senator who's on a key committee, he wants your vote. He'll sign you up for a big book contract. He knows how to get things done. And, of course, we now learn he was practically a member of Tony Blair's cabinet.
Yeah, and the Wall Street Journal sliding toward that pocket. More on that very soon, I'm sure. I want to thank all of our callers today and each of you for being with us. Margaret Tolov at the McClatchy Newspapers, National Congressional Correspondent there. Thanks very much for joining us, Margaret.
My pleasure, Tom.
Trudy Rubin at the Philadelphia Inquirer, Foreign Affairs Columnist there. Trudy, it's always great to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Jack, thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.